Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Nearly 100 years since his death, Bat Masterson still holds great influence. Remembered by many for his adventures in America's Old West, buffalo hunter, scout, gunfighter, and even lawman as Dodge City Sheriff. In 20th century New York City, he became a sports writer. However, Masterson left a legacy that is much more intricate. Masterson always stood up for the underdog, and his real legacy was how he fought for them. After the days of the Old West were over, he laid down his gun and picked up his pen. So great was his writing that he was vastly respected for his opinions on many topics of the day, including crime, politics, and war. But Bat Masterson had a secret, one that he kept well hidden his entire life, for if known, he and all those he cared about would be ruined. His reputation and all that he worked for in his life would be in tatters. The book that we're featuring this evening is Bat Masterson, The First Dreamer, with my special guest, journalist and author, Fred Rosen. Welcome back to the program, Fred Rosen.
Well, Dan, it is a huge pleasure to be here talking to you about this book. It's a huge pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry for interrupting you. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on, and the first interview you've done about this book, so I feel privileged to have you on talking about this book. Again, as I mentioned before, so many parallels to today's political situation, but Bat Masterson, you've brought to life. Tell our audience, Fred, how important this book, Bat Masterson, is to you. How long have you wanted to write this book? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, boy. I knew you were going to ask that. Give me a second. I've wanted to write this book for over 40 years. And, gee, I guess I'm dating myself. But what happened was, when I was a child, I watched the TV series, and it was the late 50s. I was a child then, but I was a huge fan of Westerns, TV Westerns, which were they were the most popular genre at that point. This is before reality shows. There was a show called Bat Masterson, and I got into watching it. And at the very end of the show, Dan, there was the final title card that said, based on the book by Richard O'Connor. And I'm a kid, and I'm sitting there, and I'm going, wait a second, the guy's real?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it, you know? And then I went, gee, that's something. And then in the 1970s, I was still interested, and I started doing some research, and I find out the guy comes to New York City and becomes a reporter. But even more than that, what he becomes best known for as a reporter, though he comes here as a sports writer, he writes a big story about what became known as the first trial of the century, 1906. And this was a murder case. Murder, depending upon who you talk to, and where a guy gets a girl pregnant and then drowns her because he doesn't want to have her kid, supposedly, or he doesn't want her to have the kid, supposedly. Okay, becomes the basis for Dreyse's An American Tragedy. The film A Place in the Sun with Montgomery Clift and Liz Taylor. And but the truth gets lost, okay, which is that this was the most sensational murder case in the history of New York. And the guy that covered it for his newspaper was Bat Masterson, and he solves it. And that's what got me. You know, the fact that he solved it, Dan, and he here was a guy that already worked on quite a few murder cases.
Right. Take us back as you do, because we're going to hold back the secret. But tell us, it won't be long before that's revealed, but let's find out about his background, about his mother and his father and his life growing up. And tell us a little bit about Thomas and his wife, Catherine, and their life, where they came from originally and where they were from before they moved to Missouri. Tell us a little
bit. I'll tell you about it, but I also have to say to everybody listening today that I don't, you know, I believe in you can call it faith, you can call it God. It's no accident that you're interviewing me about this because you're Canadian. Well, so was Bat Masterson, and that was the point. Bat Masterson was what today we call a dreamer. He came to America from Canada as a child in the early 1860s, and he in those days it was legal. It really was an open border, okay. But it all changed, and that was what was so fascinating to me, Dan, about this. From, I don't even think it, I could, I guess I could say a political point of view, but see, today in America, and I'm sure, you know, you see this, they're always writing about dreamers from the southern border, and our president is against them.
Right.
Well, when I was writing this book, I said, you know something, I got a choice here. Okay, I can either get political or I can report the facts. And I thought about you, and I said, boyfriend, if you don't report the facts, Dan will give you a hard time. So I did my reporting, and I was shocked, okay? I was shocked to find out how many presidents we've had going back to Millard Fillmore. We're talking 1850s, who were – today they call them nationalists, nativists, okay?
Right.
And Masterson's family, his mother was from Ireland. His father was his father's family came from Ireland, but he was a native Canadian in Quebec province. I got to be careful how I pronounce it. And they, like many individuals around the world, from then until now, looked at our country as a place to go and find a new life. And so they moved into upstate New York. And but for whatever reason, it didn't work for them, and they kept doing what a lot of people did. They went west, and literally west. I mean, you know, it's pretty far west to go from New York to Kansas, especially in those days, but they did it. And that's, of course, where Masterson grew up and his reputation was developed.
You talk about how they got to this journey to the west and to Missouri,
yes,
finally. And you say it was a dangerous time as well, and there were still gangs roaming the state supporting one side or other from the Civil War, including Jesse and Frank James. They start robbing banks in Missouri in 1870. you talk about the census in 1870.
Mm-hmm.
What did they have to say to the census takers at that time in 1870?
Well,
we'll see how that changes.
Well, that's where it gets very interesting when you compare it to what's happening, at least in this country today, okay? What happened was is when Masterson's family was his father was questioned about, you know, by the census in those days, and I believe this went up until the 1950s. You had a question on the census about where you came from, and his father said the truth that they came from Canada, because at that point it was not illegal. That changed. Because when I say it was not illegal to come from Canada, what I mean was they never applied for citizenship. They just walked across the border, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that all changed. And that again, it was so shocking to me, because you're finding out stuff they didn't teach in high school, you know. But I got to tell you, thank God, I had seven homicides that Masterson was involved in, including four that he was responsible for. And that was fascinating to be able to go in between, you know, like I'm writing about what's happening politically, et cetera, for people. But and then at that point, you know, he's involved in a murder case, you know, and that's what really got to me, which is I had no, you know, because, again, this is the real guy, not the guy from TV. You know, and that's very important. Even though the show is based on a book, they fictionalized most of it. You know, the only thing they didn't fictionalize was the betrayal. The betrayal was extremely accurate.
Now, you write that June 6, 1871, Thomas Masterson bought an 80-acre farm in Sedgwick County, Kansas. This is about 14 miles northeast of Wichita. And that was a burgeoning Kansas cattle town at that time. Bartholomew, or Bat, was 18 at that time. You say he was about 5'9", muscular, good-looking guy. How did he acquire his education? This is what I thought was fascinating. Where did he get educated through, as you write?
Well, again, that's really fascinating. He essentially was self-educated. Now, that is, whenever his parents were traveling, you know, earlier than that, you know, when he was, let's say, 10, 12, whatever, you know, you would expect that they would there's no record of this, but you would expect that they would enroll in a local school, whether they were living in Missouri or Illinois, because they lived in all these places. But what happened was, in some way, this guy decided to really educate himself, and he became a vociferous reader. And again, it's incredible. The guy wound up having an incredible talent as a writer. And I'm not just saying that. I mean, I got to tell you, when I went down to the New York Public Library on 42nd Street, Manhattan, to find his columns, Dan.
Right.
You know, because I find a guy's columns, and I'm reading, and this is the first time I've been able to read his columns. Blew me away. I couldn't believe how talented he was as a writer, and also the fact that when he reported on Jack Johnson, who was the first African, he was first black heavyweight champ of the world. Well, everybody else wrote nasty things about him. You know what I mean? You know, racial epithets. Not that Masterson. He would describe Jack Johnson as Johnson or the Negro, one of the two. That was it. And so that blew me away. And then when you start going a little bit further and you find out how he stood up for people. Oh my, you know, that part of it is really something. You know, how he stood up for people.
Let's get back to his beginnings,
yeah.
though. When you talk about he's 18 years old, and this is, again, super interesting in terms of this guy's varied background, what he ends up doing in his entire life. You say he ends up being a sports writer. It seems unlikely when you talk about this kind of beginning. You talk about he was a terrific shot. So what was a job that he and his brothers found that they could do and do well?
Well, what happened was, boy, you're right. And what happened was, in those days, you had herds of buffalo roaming across the plains of the United States, and they decided to become buffalo hunters. And there was nothing unusual about that in those days, especially considering that they were immigrants. Because, you know, there's not much difference between then and now. You know, in terms of immigrants taking jobs that a lot of people don't want to take, you know, who've been here for a while, you know, so they became, he became a buffalo hunter. He had to skin the animals. And he did all of this work with his brother, mostly with his brother Ed, sometimes his brother Jim as well. But what happened was he was a terrific shot. It was just a talent. And so that, as a result of that, that's how he gets his nickname. Okay, because his real name is William Bartholomew. But what happens is there had been a famous hunter who his name was Old Bat. And what happened was Masterson has such a tremendous eye as a hunter, people started calling him Bat. And from that point onward, he used the name. And, of course, he did the other thing, which is he changed his middle name from Bartholomew to Barclay. And so now he's William Barclay Bat Masterson, which, again, is like what a lot of immigrants do. They reinvent themselves. That's exactly what he did.
Mm-hmm. You say at the time he'd been shooting buffalo for a few years, but Masterson became a lifelong friend of a horse thief who had escaped jail and then gone west to establish a new identity. This is a central figure in this incredible story of Bat Masterson. Who is this lifelong friend that establishes a new identity?
Wyatt Earp. It was Wyatt Earp. He becomes friends with Wyatt Earp. He meets him as a buffalo hunter. And again, I was very surprised. Like most people, I believe, you know, like the TV series, we had a TV series called The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, and I believed it. And, of course, not too long ago, in the middle 90s, Kurt Russell did Tombstone. And while Tombstone was fairly accurate, okay, in terms of what happened, and also very accurate in terms of Earp's personality, because he's a killer in that film. But that's not the way that people have accepted Wyatt. They look at him as being the same as Masterson, a law officer, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a different story. He was his good buddy, you know, and that was what's so interesting also about it is, like, because of this Dodge City place, it's like everybody wound up there one way or the other. You know, you mentioned two of the other guys that wound up there, Frank and Jesse James. I mean, I cracked up when I was writing that. It's a small scene, but I cracked up when Masterson has to confront Frank and Jesse James. Well, I just laughed at that. You know, it's just that it's all of these people, you know, that he knew. And he knew everybody. That's the other thing. You know, because of his celebrity status, man, that guy knew, Masterson knew everybody.
You write in the book, which I find fascinating too, is that all of these things are interconnected, this buffalo hunt, and we're talking about incredible numbers of buffalo killed every day and skinned and their carcasses left on the prairie, as you say. And again, what you mentioned was that it was the immigrant. It wasn't a great job. These people were called stinkers because they stunk from doing this job. The idea that also politically there was a reason for this buffalo hunt and these buffalo hunters. What was the reason behind this incredible decimation of the buffalo on the plains?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll explain it. Our government had decided that they wanted to get rid of the Indians, and the way they were going to get rid of the Indians was to destroy their source of food and clothing, which is the buffalo. So the idea is kill the buffalo, and eventually the Indians will leave or whatever. I don't know what they thought they were going to do. but they figured that would get rid of them in one way or the other. Maybe they thought they'd starve to death. I'm pretty sure they probably were thinking about that. I mean, they were really, the cruelty is incredible. The cruelty that our government engaged in. But again, this is just, it's all part of history, I guess, right?
Yeah. You talk about Dodge City and talk about the reservation system as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, maybe a lot of people know this, but I mean, what's always fascinating is these policies and what they did with the tribes that were around this Dodge City, for example. Tell us a little bit about the government's efforts to be able to rein these people in on reserves, and what was the alternative if they left the reserve?
Oh, well, oh boy. If the Indians left the reservation for any reason, they were considered federal fugitives, and they would be tracked down and either captured or shot. That's the way that our government was treating the indigenous people of this nation.
Right.
And where it gets interesting for Masterson is that not only does he wind up as a buffalo hunter, of course, but he later on becomes what they called an Indian fighter.
He's also what's considered a good scout as well, and also they understand his prowess with a rifle. He later says, though, that he doesn't actually believe, again, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but he doesn't actually believe he shot any Indians whatsoever.
He was funny at some point, where he was asked that under oath in a civil case in New York City, and he said he was being asked how many Indians he shot, and he went, "Well, I don't know. Don't blame me if I didn't shoot any." That's basically what the guy said, because he was in a situation where he was being attacked. And he was with buffalo hunters, and they opened fire, and sure, it was hard to tell what happened. It's a good point, actually. It's a very good point.
How does Bat get to this situation where he is recognized as a potential lawman? And tell us a little bit more about Dodge City and also about his other cohorts, these famous legends of the West, also seem to transform themselves into lawmen. Tell us about this process that does this and the new job for Bat Masterson.
Yeah. That's a good question. What happens is he has, by the time he gets to Dodge City, and again, we're talking about a very young man in his early 20s, he's already been an Indian fighter and a buffalo hunter, which means he's used to using a gun. But he's never shot a man. Well, that, actually, that's not quite true. He did. He shot his first man in when he was a buffalo hunter who was trying to who shot him and left him with a limp, which is where the cane comes in. But when he comes to Dodge City, he's able to change, and I believe it's because he's able to change his career path, and I think he's able to change it because of the fact that he has a very strong set of values, and he decides to get into law enforcement. His friend Herb helps him do it. And eventually he becomes a politician and runs for office. You know, people don't necessarily think of it that way, but when you run for sheriff, you're a politician. You know, you're running for office.
Sure.
And he, while he was a terrific sheriff, he was a lousy politician. He was very bad as a politician.
You write about Bat meeting Molly. He's 22 at the time. She's younger. And this is January 1876.
Mm-hmm.
They're an unlikely couple. But tell us where they meet and what happens with the relationship. And before we introduce this Corporal King.
Yeah. Well,
Melvin A. King.
What happens is Masterson gets involved with it's a new settlement called Hightown, and he gets when he's there, he winds up at the gaming tables, you know, just like in the movies, folks. And he's a gambler, and there's a girl there, and it's unclear whether Molly was a prostitute or not, but she was a quote-unquote dance hall girl. She worked in a local dance hall. And they fall in love. That part is very clear. And they wind up going into this dance hall, and should I get into King?
Sure, a little bit, sure, why not?
Okay, well, what happens is, this is, man, it's really something. King gets drunk. King is playing poker with Masterson, doesn't like him for whatever reason, and he sees he's friendly with this woman, and he follows them into the dance hall, takes out his gun, and goes bang. Masterson goes down with a bullet through the intestines, and that's the one that leaves him with the limp. But anyway, second time Masterson doesn't get a chance to shoot yet. He's on the floor, and the guy decides to shoot again, and Molly throws herself in front of the bullet. I mean, it's a movie image.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Masterson is able to get his gun hand free, and he shoots this guy, Sergeant Melvin A. King, and who will eventually die. And the guy was an Army guy. So, it was the first time Masterson shoots another human being. And I think what's interesting about it, Dan, as we're talking, is as opposed to later in his career, he doesn't shoot the guy that quickly. And I think the reason he didn't is because he'd never shot a man. It's a completely different situation shooting a human being from shooting an animal.
Mm-hmm.
But he always got that. He always got that, and he always valued human life.
Yeah. You write, too, what's interesting is that at the time, there was so much fear of once they had surgery, there was no hygiene employed whatsoever, so people died as a result of the operation rather than saving their life. In this particular case, they couldn't operate on him, and you say that saved his life, even though he was seriously wounded. All he ended up with was this obvious limp that he had forever and used a cane occasionally, which came
right
in handy.
Right, and of course, when I was writing about, you know, the lack of sepsis at that point, I reminded me of Garfield, who I, you know, my Garfield book, which I spoke to you about, because the same situation. The same situation.
Yeah.
It's earlier, but it's the same situation. I mean, in those days, if somebody operated on you, you had a pretty good chance of dying from the guys operating on you because they didn't wash their hands. So he was very, 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 very lucky that way. Yeah, I mean, you know, now as you're saying it, I'm thinking, wow, he really lucked out.
A year before this happens, a year before Bat meets Molly, before she dies, there's the Page Act. So we're going back a little bit. This is the first time you write, this is President Ulysses Grant. This is the first immigration law to prohibit specific groups of immigrants the government claimed as undesirables. Who were those first people? And we will talk about the further immigration acts that are passed and their impact and what Bat has to say about it and what does he do. Who did they ban first?
The Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was basically what you see happening is racism. You know, racism. And but also what was interesting about it was the why of it. The why of it that I didn't realize that there are a lot of Chinese immigrants that were taking jobs from people on the West Coast. So the West Coasters didn't want those people here, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't want them here. So it was be a lot easier to just ban them. And you know, by the way, earlier when we were talking about the Mastersons and where they came from and the fact that they were Irish Catholics, well, Catholics also had a hard time in the United States for a lot of years. You know, we unfortunately we have this history.
You talk about the Wild Bill Hickok, again,
yeah,
another legend, and the poker game where we get the idea of the dead man's hand. What happens? Tell us about this little story about Wild Bill.
That's the last thing I expected you to ask me, but that's cool. What happens is this. This is Deadwood, South Dakota. And Wild Bill Hickok is a former Pony Express rider. He's a former scout, also like Masterson. And he becomes a gambler, and which is what a lot of these guys did. And he's sitting at a table with a guy whose name was Broken Nose Jack McCall. And he says something to McCall that McCall doesn't like. And what happens is McCall gets up, leaves, and Hickok, unlike in the movies, he's not sitting with his back to the wall. He's like, you know, in the middle of the room. And this guy, McCall comes up to him and shoots him. And Hickok falls over, and his poker hand comes out, and it's a poker hand of aces and eights. The dead man's hand. That's how it became known as the dead man's hand.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, these things happen, and, you know, here we're talking about something, and, you know, in the 1860s, you know, and here we are today talking about it.
You write that shortly after Hickok's murder, Wyatt and his brothers left Dodge City for Deadwood to make some money.
Yes.
And they stopped off at Sidney, Nebraska. This is September 1876. And Wyatt ran into his old friend, Bat. And Wyatt was an assistant city marshal of Dodge City. Talk about a reinventing yourself. Ford County, Kansas. And he said to Bat, it pays a lot better than buffalo hunting. And there weren't really any buffalo left anyway. So tell us about this. Earp makes him a deputy. And so what are some of the things that happened shortly after in their duty in Dodge City?
Well, what happens is Masterson goes to Dodge City, and he still has his cane at that point. He's still using the cane. And he becomes known for using the cane to stop obstreperous bad guys. There's a thing called buffaloing, which is when somebody takes a six gun and puts it on your head. And that Earp became very good at that, as opposed to shooting the person. Masterson preferred using the cane, but while he's in Dodge City, he and Earp get involved in quite a few situations where they've got to take their gun out and they've got to track down bad guys and stuff like that.
Yeah. You talk about his brothers too, Masterson's brothers, Ed and Jim, and they follow him into law enforcement as well.
Yes. Oh boy. Yes. And it's interesting because Jim is younger. Ed is the oldest brother, and they follow him into law enforcement. And Ed has a different kind of personality from Masterson. Ed is a much more of a, gregarious sort. He doesn't have the same level of, he doesn't seem as serious about it, being a cop, as Bat does. And that actually proves to be a problem.
And go on.
Well, what happens is, Ed tries to stop. Ed is one of Bat's deputies, and he tries to stop some guys who are drunk. They have a law in Dodge City, which is you're not allowed to carry a handgun beyond a certain point. And what happens is these two guys who are drovers from Texas, they get drunk, which of course never goes with guns. Nothing has changed that way. And what happens is Ed tries to disarm these guys, and instead one of them turns the gun on him and shoots him and sets his shirt on fire from the muzzle blast. And it happens purely by coincidence that Masterson at that point is approaching the saloon where this occurs. And so he actually sees his brother go down. And he takes out his gun and he shoots dead the two guys that had shot his brother. And, I mean, what's fascinating about it is there were a couple of other individuals that hung out with the two bad guys, the two killers of Ed Masterson. And later on, Matheson arrests them, and he's in a situation where he could easily have shot these guys, and people would have said, that's fine. Because his brother Ed was very well-liked, and so was Matheson, but he didn't do it. He did the right thing. He let them go because
right.
there was no evidence they were involved. That's pretty interesting. You know, I can tell you right away, Wyatt Earp would never do that.
You talk about Bat becoming interested in writing letters to the editor and I guess getting responses. So he thinks, why not? Why don't I start a newspaper, the Vox Populi,
yes.
in Dodge City, 1884. Tell us a little bit about this paper, what it consisted of, and what kind of success it enjoyed.
Well, he does. It's essentially one issue. Okay, so it's not successful. But what he learns is he writes a newspaper that rails. Basically, it's editorializing, and it rails against various politicians. Rails against a local editor that doesn't like him, but it really gives me what Masterson a background in journalism. He learns a little bit, not a little bit. He learns a lot, and I suppose the most important thing, not I suppose the most important thing is he learns he's a writer. And that's pretty interesting because I had the same experience. You know, I didn't know I was a writer until I was 23. I thought everybody could put words on page
right.
the way I did it. You need some experience to change it, or you need somebody to encourage you. So in Masterson's case, he starts a newspaper and he finds he really enjoys writing. He enjoys writing and he enjoys it a heck of a lot more than being a lawman.
You talk about the other things that interest this fascinating guy, Bat Masterson, is that he heads to Denver and mm-hmm. he's interested in gambling. There's no gambling in New York State. It's illegal.
Right.
But he's in the gambling parlors and we're talking about 25 dealers and up to 200 players in this Denver's Palace Theater and gambling parlor. This is where he meets Emma Moulton. She was performing there. Tell us a little bit about this relationship and what happens as a result of these two people meeting.
Well, that's what's interesting. This is the third. No, this is the yeah. This is the second big. Relationship in his life with Emma Moulton. And Emma it was a she juggled Indian clubs. She was
yeah.
known as the queen of clubs, okay? And but she's a performer, and they meet and they really do fall in love. I mean but she's married. She's married to a guy, and so it's going to take a while for that to fade, you know, where she's going to divorce the guy. while in Denver with Emma and doing this, that's really where Masterson gets into boxing. And I had no idea that these old West lawmen, and it wasn't just Masterson, Earp was involved in boxing too, they got involved in professional boxing for various reasons. And so Denver is the place that he gets involved with Emma, and he gets involved in boxing, and he gets another opportunity to write a column for a local paper, which he really digs, about boxing.
Yeah. You talk about it almost at the same time, or in 1894, big things happen in government. There is the William Henry Harrison president. he favors tariffs, and of course his opponent doesn't. But he got Congress to pass. And Cleveland was the person that he was versus, and didn't agree with the tariffs.
Ooh.
Also with the tariffs, interestingly, comes new immigration law, and you write that this is the first time that there are mass deportations in U.S. history.
Yes.
Tell us
a
little bit about that.
Well, that's the part that's just so, it was so fascinating to me because of what's happening today. And what I learned was that whatever, they always have a different name for the Immigration Bureau, whatever you want to call it. But let's just say the Immigration Bureau, okay? And what they did was they kept tightening up the immigration regulations. And you know what, Dan? I'm glad you mentioned that because, I have a friend whose daughter is epileptic. And Emma Masterson was epileptic. Well, guess what? Our government decided to ban anybody who had epilepsy from coming to this country.
Right.
They did all kinds of stuff like this. I'm sitting here, I'm shaking my head. It's like, who are these people? I'll tell you something. What's really interesting is, when I looked at all these presidents, and you mentioned Cleveland and so forth, in Masterson's time, of course, the guy that stands out is Abraham Lincoln. He spoke out against these people. And I always say the same thing, where are these people today? But seriously, it's just what our government was doing was just awful. Wow.
You talk about Bat working at New York, at the Morning Telegraph.
Oh, yeah.
And then in 1901, this is another fascinating thing. He becomes good friends with Teddy Roosevelt, the president of the United States, the youngest president at 43 years old.
Yes, sir.
And he's working with a publisher, Alfred Henry Lewis. And who had written a lot of books about and articles about the Old West himself, particularly
right.
the gunfighter legends. So then he wants to put a good word in. Tell us about this good word, Teddy Roosevelt, and the offer that's offered Bat Masterson.
Wow. Oh, boy. Okay. Well, what happens is, there's an opening in the federal government for the marshal of the state of Oklahoma. Well, this guy Lewis talks to his buddy T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, says, listen, why don't you ask my buddy Masterson to do it? He's cool. He'll do it. He's great. And so T.R. asks Masterson to do this, and Masterson turns it down. And when I read his turn down, the guy turns down the president of the United States, and he turns it down. And I'm reading this, and I'm going, "What's this about?" And a friend of mine said to me, "Fred, why don't you check and see if the federal marshal has to be confirmed by the Senate?" Well, that's the case. Masterson knew he could never get through the Senate because they find out he was an illegal alien. And so he turns TR down, at which point TR decides to appoint Masterson deputy federal marshal of the Southern District of New York. Folks, wherever you're listening, I know Barry Collins is in Scotland.
Yeah.
Wherever you're listening, I got to tell you something, okay? What we're saying here is Bat Masterson, who was the sheriff of Dodge City, or Fort County, Kansas, which included Dodge, we're saying he was the deputy federal marshal of New York City. Of New York City. And people knew who he was. And he's doing this at the same time as he's being a reporter, which means we got ourselves a reporter walking around with a gun.
The interesting thing is why he accepted that and why it worked out. You don't explain really why, but, you know, Bat knew very well why he denied the first job offer. But this
mm-hmm.
one came with no confirmation process, so he was able
right.
to take that easily. So he has a prestigious
right.
job, an important job, but most important, nobody knows the secret. Let's
right.
get to this
nope.
murder at Big
mm-hmm.
Moose Lake, because
mm-hmm.
this is the thing that's the most
Ooh.
Fascinating part of his story. He does all kinds of other reporting. Of course, the sports reporting is fascinating because it's analysis. He finds and discovers, of course, as a good reporter, that some of these fights are fixed. So that's another fascinating
right.
aspect of his career. But this really defines so much about him, is his murder at Big Moose Lake. Give us the background about this, Chester Gillette and Miss Grace Brown.
Okay, this is what would become known as the first trial of the 20th century, long before O.J., okay? And
right.
what happens here is this fella named Chester Gillette, who comes from a fairly well-off family, but he's on the wrong side, and he's working managing a factory for his uncle in Herkimer, New York. Well, no, it wasn't Herkimer. It was nearby Herkimer. But Herkimer is the county, okay? The point is, he meets a girl named Grace Brown, and whether or not they fell in love is anybody's guess. What isn't, what isn't is that she gets pregnant with his child. And and she's really upset because she wants to get married, you know, because in those days, that's, you know, it was a different situation. Well, I don't know how much has things changed, whatever. Anyway, so what happens is he decides, Chester Gillette, oh boy, and I was thinking about you, Dan, when I went to Herkimer. What happened is he decided he was going to take Grace on a lake, Big Moose Lake. They're going to go boating. Now, here's the thing. I've gone to Herkimer where Chester Gillette would later be tried, but Big Moose Lake is about 70 miles north in the Appalachian Mountains, and I'm talking, I've been in almost every state, Dan, and quite a few of the provinces. This was the most isolated place I've ever been to in my life. No question, if you want, but before I went there, when I'd been at the place where he subsequently was tried, I said to myself, wait a second, I got to drive 70 miles north into no place in order to find this place. But if I'm going to write about the murder, I got to find out where the heck this happened so that I've got some authority. So I drove up there, okay, and I looked around, took pictures, and then I sort of compared what happened to, I certainly compared it to the book that was written about it, An American Tragedy by Dreiser, and the movie A Place in the Sun with Liz Taylor and Monty Clift. But what got me was the fact that Bat Masterson covered the case. His editor assigned him to go up to the trial. So in other words, what happens is, I should explain, the woman dies. She allegedly is thrown overboard by Chester Gillette, Grace Brown. But there's very little physical evidence to show that. It's just a supposition. And Grace had actually written quite a few notes that where she talked about suicide. So Masterson goes to cover the trial in Herkimer, New York. I can't tell you what it was like walking the same pavement that my idol did. It was incredible. And I got into the same courtroom where the trial took place, where Chester Gillette was tried for killing Grace Brown and was convicted and sentenced to the electric chair. And what happens? During the jury's being out considering their verdict, Dan, a mob forms, a lynch mob.
Right.
And there's Bat Masterson. Holy moly. I mean, Bat Masterson, and what happens is Masterson then writes an article about it where he calls the headline is New Style Lynch Law in Upstate New York, which gets him in a lot of trouble with the court.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
He felt that the threat of the mob lynching Gillette affected the verdict completely. He said, in print, he said there would have been no other verdict other than this verdict because of the effect of that lynch mob on the case.
Boy, you're right. I mean, yes. I'm glad you pointed that out. That's exactly what happened. So he felt it was the wrong verdict for a lot of reasons, but that was the main reason. The jury was being intimidated into convicting the guy.
You say there was a couple other irregularities, and also in the trial that Bat noticed and noted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a result of this criticism, what happened to his publisher and himself? This is another incredible part of this. What happened as a result?
Well,
of
what happened? What happened was, not sure if it was the first, but the judge, who it turned out wanted to run for higher office, he didn't like the fact that Masterson, who was a big celebrity, was criticizing him in a New York paper. So he found Masterson and his publisher in contempt of court. Now, obviously, that wouldn't hold up in the Supreme Court because of the First Amendment. But what happens is the judge sends the sheriff from Herkimer County down to New York to arrest Masterson and his publisher and take him back up to a hearing in front of him in Herkimer, and that's exactly what happens. And rather than take the case to the Supreme Court, which of course would have cost a lot of money, they just decided to pay a $50 fine. And that's what happens. But I'll tell you what was so fascinating about it was not just the fact that the judge tried this; all the newspapers covered it. It wasn't just in Masterson's Morning Telegraph. I mean, the New York Times. Thank God for the New York Times. You know, you can read about this. It's in the book, you know, where I write about this. And that all these papers covered the fact that Masterson was, was found, in contempt of court, whatever the heck the guy called it.
You write that it didn't hurt him, his journalistic reputation. But what's even more fascinating too is that how the, you know, talk about trial by press, these guys in sync with the recently released novel Dracula, a bestseller in 1899, How do they depict this Chester Gillette and this crime?
Well, Chester Gillette was depicted as a vampire. It was very interesting. He was basically depicted that way by the press across the United States. I can tell you that it started with the local press there in Herkimer, New York. And he was just depicted as being, you know, Dracula. He was depicted as being Dracula. And this is before Bela Lugosi, but the book was out. And, come to think, I guess Frankenstein wouldn't work, but he certainly was like Dracula. No question.
Yeah. What I found interesting in this is, did Bat Masterson as a journalist, he didn't come out and say guilt one way or another. He just, as a proper journalist, had issues with a defense team that was breaking the rules of disclosure or some of the, again, irregularities that were allowed by the Judge Devenport.
Oh, the prosecution was, oh, man. They did something, to give an idea about an irregularity, I've never seen this. As we said earlier, Grace Brown was pregnant. What did they do?
Yeah.
They took the fetus from her body and put it into formaldehyde and brought it into court as evidence. Excuse me?
Yeah.
You know, that has no probative value.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. But there were those kinds of irregularities, and
how about,
you know,
the body? How about the body and the coroner? They sidestepped that process.
Oh boy, the body. Oh boy, they. Oh boy, they sent the body. Oh boy, the body was embalmed before
first,
the coroner got a hold of it. And even in those days, they knew that could destroy evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, you know, this is the kind of case that today it would never hold up. Boom, it'd be out, you know, it would never hold up. But they got away with it. They got away with it because there was so much press against Gillette. That's the reason they got away with it. People wanted this guy to die.
Bat, though, did think that he was not a killer. So what did Bat Masterson suppose happened that day with this woman that was distraught? She had been separated from this, her manager boss, her lover, and had written these letters that were foremost in the trial, all these heartfelt letters. But she also said many times in those letters that she wanted to die. Could she die? Talking about, obviously, suicidal thoughts. So what did Bat Masterson think happened? Because he talks about that his attorney, Chester's attorney, had said that he was a coward,
right,
a moral coward. So what do you think Bat Masterson thought had happened rather than the official line?
I think that what Bat thought happened was that when they went out on the boat, she, Grace Brown, was clearly very upset, and he thought that she had gone overboard on her own. She just had gotten up and went in. And it's funny, actually, because when I watched that scene in the film A Place in the Sun, 1952 George Stevens film, that's basically the way they do it, which is interesting. They actually got that right. So in other words, what we're saying here is there's no direct evidence of murder. They tried to, the prosecution tried to say that some of her hair that was found near the bottom of the boat occurred because he knocked her down or something. Oh yeah, that was the other thing. Gee, I almost forgot. I feel like Columbo. I almost forgot. The prosecution's theory about how did Chester Gillette kill her? He hit her with his tennis racket.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, and which again, when I read that, I just went, "This is ridiculous." Who kills somebody with a tennis racket? It's ridiculous, you know, and they weren't able to prove that any bruises on her were from a tennis racket or anything else. But that's what they told the jury, and the jury bought it. Well, apparently bought it.
Well, like you say, after that, he was sued. They gave him a small fine. It was $50. It was a pragmatic thing to do for Bat, even though he hated to admit anything, to say he was guilty of anything that he certainly wasn't. You talk about other relationships like Damien Runyon, that's essential
Runyon, yes.
in his legacy. But you talk about Teddy Roosevelt, and he had backed William Howard Taft. Taft won, and Teddy Roosevelt had this last reception, and he invited Bat Masterson to come because they're friends and they mean a lot to each other. What does Bat do?
And Bat decided not to go, and I was trying to figure that one out, and I make a supposition in the book that because he was friends with the guy, but what I noticed is that Masterson stayed away from situations where he was in crowds, where people would question him about things. Because he had something to hide. You know, he had something to hide. I mean, one of the things I tried, you know, I looked at very closely is whether or not he might have told the TR that he was an alien. But I realized very quickly that if he'd done that, TR would have reported him. So so when he decided not to go Teddy Roosevelt's last luncheon, I think it was more because he just didn't want to socialize with people. He was afraid that, you know, I guess you just never know. I mean, to me, the guy seems, Masterson seems like he was very cautious personally. And he was very cautious personally in his relationships with people. You know, one of the things I found interesting. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, one of the things I found interesting was that later in his life, he doesn't have anything to do with Wyatt Earp, who's still alive. I found that really interesting, that there was a diversion, not a diversion, there's a dichotomy between these people because they're always put together. But in his life, there was certain one or two points where he could have used Earp's help. He didn't, you know, later on, he didn't call him.
Yeah.
And when I say call him, I mean call him. You know, we had phones then.
There's so much that historically that's happens in these short few years that Bat Masterson is an integral part of American history. Include the Mann Act of 1910, and also it's demonstrated by a particular event in boxing that Masterson is involved with and comments on and finds it important, obviously, because of this historical importance. And this is this Jack Johnson, and accused by a woman of kidnapping her daughter and bringing her across state lines. Woodrow Wilson is the president at the time. You call him a racist president. Tell us about this frame-up of Johnson and what Masterson writes and concludes.
Well, the thing is, it's a lot. That's a lot. What happens is the Mann Act is a federal law still in effect, as far as I know, that prevents a person from taking another person, of course, across state lines for the purpose of sex. So Johnson goes across state lines with this woman who I think he later marries her, okay? But the government goes after him, and Wilson goes after him. And Wilson's Justice Department goes after him and finds him guilty. And at this point, he's the heavyweight champ of the world. finds him guilty of violating the Mann Act, and what happens? He's got to leave the country. And so he leaves the country, and he finally fighting Jess Willard in Cuba, of all places. And that covers the trial. And what's really, really interesting about it is that the way it's written down in history is that Willard knocks out Johnson, okay? Well,
right.
What really happens is at some point Jackson's on the canvas. He looks up at the sun because this is outside, and he shields his eyes. But meanwhile, he's talking back and forth with his wife, who's sitting ringside. Okay? Yeah. And Masterson notices this. And basically what Masterson notices is, and Jack Johnson will later confess that he threw the fight, that he was paid off. And Masterson was basically noticing how this went down. That's what I find so interesting about the guy as a journalist, Dan. He really paid attention, unlike a lot of journalists today.
Yeah. He also writes that it was fascinating, too, that at that point when he looked up to block the sun, he was supposed to be incapacitated on the mat. But he had been waiting for his wife to signal him because he wouldn't throw that fight till he knew his wife had that money. And I think they shirked him on the money anyway. But if they didn't, they waited to the 26th. Unbelievable. The 26th. Round, and by all accounts, he was winning this fight easily. He wasn't trying too hard, but he was ahead technically till this moment where he was knocked out, apparently.
And you know what the best is? The best. I'm sorry to interrupt, but the best is there's you can put this in a book, but there's video of it. There's video.
That's right, yeah.
You can watch the video. Mm-hmm. You can see it. I mean, you can see it. And then, of course, the other point is that, as you mentioned, Johnson's found guilty of the Mann Act. He wasn't cleared until 2018 when President Trump, overturned the conviction.
Yeah.
And that happened in 2000. In fact, that happened in 2018 as I was upstate. Upstate New York doing the research. But, it's something.
Yeah. You write that in 1919, Woodrow Wilson, they're looking at Canadians illegally in the U.S. He wants to defend the northern U.S. in case Canadians invade. So that's how much, we didn't go through all of the changes in the Immigration Act, but now there's more and more people that are added to the list, added to the categories that are considered undesirables and not allowed in the U.S. Isn't that true?
Yes. Dan, when I read that, I was thinking about you. I was going, does Dan know that they wanted to repel a Canadian invasion? I've never heard of anything as stupid in my life. You know what I mean? It's just incredibly stupid. And it shows how foolish our presidents can be.
Certainly, certainly. We talked about Damon Runyon, and they met, and he was Bat was an idol of his journalistically. You write.
Yeah. Yes.
And so, as a result. And there was another person named Stuart Lake was also influenced by that as well. What does this amount to later in terms of Runyon's reporting on the Old West, his writing about the Old West?
Well, Runyon, what Runyon does is he decides to use Masterson as a character in a short story that he writes, which becomes Guys and Dolls, the famous Broadway musical. And the character in the show, in the short story and then later in the show, is called Sky Masterson. Gee, you think there's a similarity there?
Sure.
So
yeah.
that's the first thing. The other thing is that you mentioned Stuart Lake. That, boy, oh boy, Stuart Lake was a newspaper, a colleague of Masterson's. He worked on another paper. And later on, he goes to Hollyweird and becomes good friends with Wyatt Earp and writes Earp's biography, which is fictionalized.
Sure.
See, that's the point, which is that the 20th century and 21st century conception of Wyatt Earp is from a fictionalized biography. And I'll just say also that I was just shocked when I found out Lake was still alive in the late 50s when they did the TV series The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, and he was technical advisor, which means there I am sitting at home watching this thing, and it's all fiction. you know, I mean, it's interesting, again, because of how these people were, you know, there's an overlapping that people don't understand in history. People's lives overlap.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I mean, my book is being published tomorrow, technically, but that's October 25th, and that's the 98th anniversary of Masterson's death.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to say 1921. What we did skip was just one important fact, that when they were trying to malign Bat Masterson and his career and his contributions, they said they had a well-mentioned rumor of how many people they said he killed. And
yes.
You do have this dramatic part in court where he has to ask the question when somebody asks him how many people he's killed. Tell us the truth versus this rumor and Bat's interesting responses at court to these allegations.
Well, he basically goes, he's involved in a legal case, and he's in court and he's being questioned by Benjamin Cardozo, who becomes a Supreme Court justice. And he asks him all about the people that he killed, and he says he tells the truth. He says there were four people, three people, and then the fourth died from wounds suffered as a result of his gunshot. But it contradicts a story that had been written about him by a newspaper reporter that said he killed like 18 people, which was all a bunch of crap. You know, this is why, you know, truth is indeed stranger than fiction here. I mean, the fact is, and also, you know, when he's asked about the Indian fighting, he's so funny, Masterson. Yeah. He says, you can't blame me if I didn't hit any of them.
Yeah.
Because he
was supposed to be an Indian hunter with so many. They depicted in the newspaper, or at least one newspaper that had it in for him, to say that he had killed 23 and how many Indians, and he'd shot these people in the back. So drunken Mexicans and Indians, and he shot them in the back.
Yes.
And that really
yes.
outraged Bat Masterson.
Yeah, he was this fight manager who he'd exposed, claimed that he made his reputation shooting Mexicans and Indians in the back. And that's when Masterson just said, that's it. I'm not, you know, and that's when he sued. And again, what I loved is the fact that he goes up against the future Supreme Court justice and beats him at his own game.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
You write that he continued to write and continued to have an audience and be successful. October 25th, 1921, Bat got to the Morning Telegraph, went up to his office and sat at his desk and to catch up on all the reporting. He said he had a cold. So what happened to him that day? And tell us, as you write in this, people discovering him at his desk, what had happened.
Well, he had a cold, and a guy from the next office, one of his colleagues, came in and asked him how he was doing. He said, fine, whatever. And then the next thing you know, the guy comes back in, and there's Masterson slumped over his typewriter, dead from a heart attack. And at that point, his death becomes, it's certainly national news. I can't say it was international. I don't know. But it becomes national news. It's all over the place. It's covered by every newspaper. I mean, I find when I look at something, you know, when you look at the New York Times, you know what I mean? It's like, whoa. You know, and so it was front page news, and it you know, the guy was considered to be he really was a legend in his own time.
You write that there was misinformation right at the end, that he was writing, and what he wrote, because that was fascinating to people, this incredibly influential journalist, what was he writing when he died right at his desk? And so it really wasn't true what he did write, but you include in this book many of the writings of Bat, so we can get a feel of his character, sense of humor,
right,
and just the way he wrote.
Right.
But he talks about in this last paragraph, and I'll just read it, "Yet there are those that argue that everything breaks even in this old dump of a world of ours. I suppose those ginks that argue that way hold that because the rich man gets ice in the summer and the poor man gets it into winter. Things are breaking even for both. Maybe so, but I'll swear I can't see it that way."
Yes. You know, that got me. He's such a good writer. Frankly, I feel like I got a lot to live up to here. And mm-hmm. He writes that. And then he writes, but that's not the last thing he writes.
No.
He goes on to write about some boxer. But what's fascinating to me, oh God, is the fact that this just happened. I'll just tell you, Dan, it happened by accident. Oh, 2 years ago, it was a hurricane that hit Houston, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
And my mother, who's 99 years old, I'm her caretaker, she says to me one day, she says, Fred, Bat Masterson's mentioned in the newspaper. I went, what? She said, he's mentioned in the newspaper. So I figured my mother must be, you know, she's going, you know. Sure enough, what happened? What happened, Dan? It turns out there was a columnist for the Washington Post who quoted what you just said, what Masterson wrote. The point being that the people in Houston were going to, that didn't have money, were going to get hurt by the hurricane. And
yeah.
So things don't break even in the world.
Yeah,
and
it's
this,
not fair.
You know, I just found it so, fascinating to me that a reporter for the Washington Post would even know this. But it says something about the man's words. They've stood the test of time.
You talk, or you write, that when he died, and it was very positive. In his death, his legend, his appraisal, people's appraisal of him as a journalist and a man.
Mm-hmm.
But they also put that his place of birth, I believe it was in Illinois.
Yes.
When did it surface that he was the first dreamer?
What happened was I had been wanting to do a book about Bat Masterson, as I've said, for many years. And I was going to do something on him in 2016, and for some reason it didn't sell, which turned out to be one of the luckiest things that ever happened to me, because I just kept looking. I had a feeling that he was holding something back, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was just a feeling, you know, Dan, you get a feeling as a, you know, as a journalist. And so I did some research on his background. And at that point, I'm going back 2 to 3 years, there really wasn't very much written about, at that point, about him coming from Quebec. And I found somebody online who'd written something who claimed to be a distant relative of his. And this person claimed that Masterson was an illegal. Well, I don't have to tell you. You read something online, you got to prove it, right?
Sure.
So I was able to use I went online and was able to use the Mormon website, which is the best when it comes to researching person's background. Next thing you know, I was able to find everything on the Mastersons regarding what they did as far as what they said, what Masterson said on these census forms, where he lied every single time. And I was also able eventually to track down his birth certificate in Quebec.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was really something, you know. But thank God we have these resources, and we've got, people have kept records, you know.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you something. When I found out that Masterson was a dreamer, I was blown away. I'm still blown away.
Yes.
I mean, I'm still blown away. I mean, I'm going to assume he's the only dreamer on he's the only illegal immigrant on a U.S. stamp. I could be wrong, but I'm, you know.
Yeah. Fred, I want to thank you and congratulate you on Bat Masterson. It's been fascinating. It's an incredible book. You can't put it down. It's so fascinating. And Bat Masterson is revealed to be one of the most fascinating characters in American history, and a very important one. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Bat Masterson, the first dreamer. For those people that might want to take a look at this book, tell us where they might take a look, who publishes this, and where they might go to look at your other past work.
Sure.
Which is
Luminous. The work is... Thank you, sir. The book is being published by R.J. Parker Publishing. It's available either at his website or just by going to Amazon.com. It's available in both print and ebook.
Fantastic. And all they have to do is go look up Amazon.com and see all your other fascinating books that we've all covered on True Murder. I want to thank you very much, Fred Rosen. It's been an absolute pleasure. You have a great evening.
Dan, I just want to say I you have been so helpful and so supportive. Thank you, sir, for having me come on and discuss this and all my other books. I appreciate it.
It's been a real privilege, Fred. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
Okay. Adios.
Bye-bye.